from the era that brought you names like Chamberlain, Russell, and West.
To Chamberlain, he's got it!
Jerry West made it from the other side of the midcourt stripe!
To the glory days of Magic and Kareem.
And Magic Johnson is out there celebrating!
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is on the brink of an NBA all-time record.
From a time where last-second shots were expected.
Here comes Kobe from way outside. Got it!
Gets it to LeBron for three for the win. Yes! LeBron James!
And rings were handed out like candy.
Now one. Here's Jordan. Yes! It is all over. The Chicago Bulls have won.
It's Duncan Dynasty with your host, Garrett Bouguet, and it starts right now.
Welcome to another episode of Duncan Dynasty. I'm your host, Garrett Bouguet, and with me this week, I've got a very special guest. He's a fellow Sports Business Classroom alum, and actually a two-time alum of that program. And he is also a big-time Knicks fan. You can follow him on Twitter, at Corn Hoops. That's K-O-R-N Hoops. I highly recommend that if you want to keep up with everything that's going on New York Knicks basketball. Brett Kornfeld is in the building. How you doing, Brett?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Garrett. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so we are going to be breaking down your beloved New York Knicks and their first round matchup against a team that is probably a little bit better than your average seven seed, the Philadelphia 76ers. So looking over just some of the basic numbers from these two teams. The Knicks finished at 50-32, and according to Cleaning the Glass, 7th in offensive rating, 10th in defensive rating, 5th overall in net rating at positive 4.9. The Sixers finished 3 games behind in the standings at 47-35, but I believe won their last 6 with Embiid back in the lineup. 15th in offense, 11th in defense, 9th overall in net rating at plus 2.8. But, you know, I guess, Brett, the first thing to discuss about this series is that both of these teams, I think, are probably better than their records indicate. Because when you look at the Knicks, I was looking up lineup data with Brunson and OG Anunoby on the floor, and even without Julius Randle, the Knicks are outscoring opponents by 22.9 points per 100 possessions. They've got a 123.9 offensive rating and a 101 defensive rating. So they've been dominant since acquiring OG. Of course, he missed a decent chunk of time with an elbow issue. But when he's been on the court, they've been a dominant basketball team. And the Sixers, when Embiid has been on the floor, 31-8 this season, which is the equivalent of around a 63-win pace. So this really seems like two juggernauts going at it.
Yeah, I think what this series ended up kind of laying out is just the Sixers are, as you mentioned, very much not the traditional seven seed. This is a team that was comfortably in the top 2-3 of the East when Embiid was going early. He was pretty much the runaway candidate to win the MVP pre his injury about 30 games into the season. Obviously finished number one in the league in EPM, even in a small games limit. And I think the thing that, you know, is exciting about this series is there's a lot to consider. And there's also a lot that we haven't seen from these two teams. These are teams that played a bunch of times this season, and none of the playoff matchups will probably resemble any of those games, given the players that were out, the different lineups. Both teams made pretty major changes to their rosters in the middle of the season. Obviously the Knicks more so than the Sixers. But there's a lot of interesting things to glean from those regular season matchups in terms of when certain guys were and were not on the court. And at the same time, there's a lot of just mystery in terms of, you know, what will the Sixers look like with this new group against this Knicks group without Randle. Pretty excited to dig into it.
Yeah, so looking at those regular season matchups, as you said, they played 4 times on January 5th. The Knicks blew out the Sixers 128-92. On February 22nd, the Knicks won 110-96. And then on March 10th, a real defensive battle, no Embiid in that game. The Sixers pulled it out 79-73. And then also they played a back-to-back set. March 12th, the Knicks got their revenge and won 106-79. And I think the main storyline here, it's got to be Embiid, right? Because He missed a bunch of time with that meniscus issue, and the Sixers were kind of vague on like what the full extent of the injury was and what even operation was done on Embiid. And some people, I thought that he might just miss the rest of the season, but he comes back towards the end. He looks great. And then right in that game against Orlando, which I believe was the second to last game of the season, he has a move where he does a Euro step in the lane and puts, you know, a lot of pressure and weight on that knee. And he requests to come out and he's limping around. And I think since then, he's been more like at 60%, more just spot up shooting, not doing those hard cuts, the sprints, those sorts of things. You brought it up in one of your tweets that he's been more in a deep drop. Again, because I think some of that mobility is gone. So, you know, if you're going to try to be an optimist for the New York Knicks on the side of things, not only has Embiid in his career been a little bit worse in the postseason than he has been in the regular season, but also if he's, again, 65-70% of the MVP that we saw early on, that gives the Knicks a much better chance.
And yeah, I think the thing that's so interesting about this is Embiid in his last four games against the Knicks, if you go back to the beginning of even last season, we're talking about a guy that's gone, you know, the usual 35, 31, 35, 30 points in each of those games. He has presented a very unique challenge for a Knicks team that if you take a look at like the matchup they had with Cleveland last year, where their size really overwhelmed Cleveland, the physicality, even at the five position for good centers like Allen and Mobley, where the offensive rebounding really came into effect. Embiid poses a unique challenge for the Knicks where the Mitch Robinson athleticism, the Hartenstein versatility in hands at the level and in drop, the way they're able to mix coverages, a lot of that stuff doesn't affect Embiid the same way it affects a lot of the guard initiators and the way that the Knicks are able to defend those guys. So he presents a really interesting matchup. And if he's not able to give you the usual Embiid, which I think you hit on perfectly, it was a lot more settling for long jumpers. It was a lot less kind of physical duck-ins into the post the way we saw in that game early in the season with the Knicks. If he's not able to give the Sixers that, it very much changes the way they're going to have to kind of initiate offense through Maxi mostly. And I think that plays much better into the Knicks' favor as we go through kind of the bulk of what this series will look like.
Yeah, and one of the prompts I gave you before we recorded was, you know, what are some of the opponent strengths that might scare either team? And I think Embiid is involved in the couple that I had written down.
Yeah.
You brought up the Knicks offensive rebounding, right? They dominated the Cavs in the playoffs last year. They're number one in the NBA this season at that as well. The Sixers ranked 26th on the defensive glass. So if you just look at that, you might say, oh, the Knicks are going to do what they did to the Cavs last year. But again, Embiid missed half the season. And the Sixers are significantly better on the defensive glass when Embiid plays just because he's a 7-2 monster, right? So, and I even think a 60% Embiid is still going to be a dominant defensive rebounder because he's absolutely huge. He's going to be standing around the basket even more probably. It'll be interesting to see how much the Knicks can take advantage of the glass. And obviously they'll still have opportunities when Embiid is resting. And, you know, Mitchell Robinson is so good on the offensive glass that I think he'll even be able to get some with Embiid on the floor. But then like looking on the other side, Embiid, of course, is this great foul drawer, right?
Yes.
And I think one of the things that has made the Knicks offense still hum even after the loss of Julius Randle is that Hartenstein, and part of it is because Robinson also got hurt, but Hartenstein has a little bit more of an offensive versatility where he can pass it from the high elbows. He's got that good little push shot. But Hartenstein, I looked at it, for his career, he's been in the 34th percentile or worse every season of his career in foul percentage. He's a guy that fouls a lot, and Embiid is a guy that is maybe the best in the NBA at drawing fouls.
100%.
So if Embiid all of a sudden is significantly reducing Hartenstein's role in this series, that's a big deal.
Yeah, I think it's one of the big swing factors. And when you asked before we hopped on, you know, what's the matchups that concern you? You know, it's pretty silly to say the reigning league MVP is the matchup that concerns me. But for this series, I think way less or way more than X factors. It's just the way the Knicks are built and how Embiid compromises some of the things that we would like to do, and vice versa. If Embiid isn't at full strength, what that will allow the Knicks to do that I think really compromises what the Sixers are able to do defensively. So I think Hartenstein's a really good point. I had him down as one of my X factors in the series. I think one of the big things that you'll notice if you go back, and I looked into it in that Miami game, you mentioned it earlier, Embiid wasn't just in kind of his traditional drop. He was really laboring. He looked exhausted. Doris called it out on the broadcast. Hartenstein is very much the Knicks' best guy in the DHO kind of action and handoff game. And the way that him and Brunson have developed this chemistry on these top of the key DHOs puts teams that play drop coverage in a really tough spot, because Brunson is so money from the mid-range. He became such a great off-the-dribble three-point shooter this year. The Knicks get a ton of looks out of that with him. They get a ton of looks out of it with Dante DiVincenzo, who's also shooting the lights out this year. And one of the things I think that Embiid in a normal circumstance would have been able to provide for the Sixers is, okay, if this isn't working, we can bring him up to the level and still feel comfortable with him at the level, getting out on these shooters, forcing the Knicks to put the ball down on the ground and then helping. If he's not going to be able to kind of consistently get to the level, I think that's going to pose a pretty significant challenge for a Sixers defense that has ranked really well the last nine games, but is going to be facing a much more potent Knicks team in terms of how they like to get their looks relative to that defense.
Yeah. Brunson, as you brought up, has killed drop all season long. He's become such an amazing player. One of my favorite guys in the league to watch at this point. And I think with Embiid, it's not as much like, is he capable of playing at the level? I think it's more he's concerned if he does that, does he tweak it again, right?
Yeah, it's all of it.
Yeah. That'll be fascinating to watch. And like, yeah, the Knicks have a lot of depth at the center position, but at the same time, yeah, I think and I'm curious to get your take on the whole conversation of like the Knicks with and without Julius Randle, and especially as like a postseason team. I would argue that they are probably a little bit, especially when they're playing OG and Hart at the 3 and 4, they're probably a slightly better defensive team without Randle out there. I don't think there's any argument to be made that they're better offensively, at least in the regular season.
Yeah.
But with the way Randle has shot in previous postseasons, I think there's an argument that when you talk about what those Randle possessions, how you're replacing them, you're talking about Brunson a little bit higher usage. You're talking DiVincenzo maybe being a little bit of a secondary creator, more Josh Hart transition offense, and more of the Hartenstein dribble handoff sort of actions. I think like just sort of by piecing together and doing a little bit, all these different guys doing a little bit more, they can sort of make up for what they've lost in Randle. But I'm curious to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think the Randle conversation can be a little bit challenging. I think one of the things that kind of gets lost to playoff history as we move, obviously he wasn't very good against Atlanta a couple years ago, especially coming off that great season that really stuck with people. Last year was a little bit different. He got hurt toward the end of the regular season. He
missed the playoff game, right?
Yeah, he missed the playoff game and he very much rushed back. And so, you know, it was kind of a compounding group of things where people were like, oh, this guy doesn't get it done in the playoffs, while also kind of, I think, merging his initial playoff failure with the Knicks with what was a pretty different situation last year, where it was pretty clear he wasn't the same player when he came back offensively. You mentioned earlier the numbers with Brunson and OG on versus with Julius off. And I think that's one of the like most interesting data points for me when I was evaluating the Knicks. The team was also incredibly successful with the three of them on, unsurprisingly, 25.69 net rating this year with all three on versus the 22.75 when you took Julius off. But I think the way they got there is what is a little concerning to me as a Knicks fan. Opponent shot 28.51% from three versus the Knicks when Julius was off the court, Brunson and OG were on. Now, could you credit some of that to the increased defensive versatility, as you said? I think you can. I think the idea that percentage goes down when you have more switchable players, you have guys that are a little bit more comfortable out on the perimeter with wings, I think that's fair. At the same time, do I think that it was a 6.2% worthwhile drop? Probably not. And if that number regresses, you know, the net rating will go down. I think on the flip side of that, you mentioned the offensive impact. I think the thing that I worry about with the playoffs is when you're scaling up roles, I think without Randle, the Knicks will have to manufacture buckets in different ways rather than have a consistent guy that can get tough buckets late in the shot clock, which, you know, when you get into the playoffs, a lot of these possessions get grinded down a little bit more. You need a couple more guys that are able to, in a break glass emergency, get you a late clock bucket or get you a late clock kick out for shooters. I think a lot of that has kind of been a struggle for the Knicks when Brunson comes off the court. And in turn, I think Tibbs's normal recourse for fixing that problem is to simply just play Brunson more minutes. And in the regular season, that kind of materialized itself where when the Knicks felt they needed to win a game, rather than kind of mix up how their bench was performing, mix up different lineup structures, try different things offensively, what they ended up going to was, we're going to play DiVincenzo 53 minutes in the regular season final. We're going to play Brunson more minutes. And I think that lack of kind of versatility offensively concerns me for a series like this, while at the same time acknowledging that it's the playoffs. Brunson's minutes are going to scale up anyway. But that's kind of where I fall on Randle. I do think they'll miss his offense more than they'll be benefited from the lack of defense, just because I think at the end of the day, you would rather have the extra creators out there.
Yeah. And, you know, part of what they did at the deadline, acquiring the likes of Alec Burks and Bojan Bogdanović, was to give them a little bit of an offensive punch, right?
Absolutely.
But right from the get-go, and, you know, this was probably pretty predictable, that Tibbs has his type of player, right? And Bojan Bogdanović is not that type of player.
Not at all. And I was curious about it when they made the trade for him, because I said, I think Leon's acquisition of Bojan was fascinating to me because he would be the worst defensive player to be in a Tibbs rotation in a long time, just full stop. And when you're watching the games, you know, his lack of mobility on that end very much jumps off the screen. At the same time, I think the optimist in me is, hey, if you're surrounding him with a ton of really potent defensive players, can you cover up some of that weaknesses? And they really need the juice he gives them shooting the basketball in pick and roll when Brunson's not initiating and types of actions like that.
And yeah, like, he at least has size and he at least like executes the scheme, right? Yeah. He's got terrible lateral mobility, as you stated, but yeah, there is optimism. Cause I think towards the end of the season, there was a game against Boston, I think, where he had a really good run. And maybe Tibbs is starting to realize that, like, yes, even though the defense is a concern, like, what he brings offensively, he's a big time talent on the offensive end of the floor. And this team just, again, especially when Brunson's off the floor, and I hope Tibbs doesn't play Brunson 48 minutes every game. But like, at least when he's off the floor, I feel like Bojan is an important piece of this team. And again, like, we'll get to X factors in a little bit, but he's a spoiler alert, one of mine. I wanted to get back to, Embiid really quick, because, you know, there's a lot of talk. We already brought up that Randle has his struggles in the postseason and Embiid has had his struggles in the postseason. And for some of the same reasons as Randle, sometimes he's had these kind of fluke injuries, right? But like, you look at the last couple of playoffs, in the 22 playoffs, Embiid's mid-range shooting dropped from 41 in the regular season to 39, his three-point shooting from 37 down to 21%. Last year's playoffs, mid-range down from 49% to 38%. Threes down from 35% to 19%.
Yep.
If he's not shooting the ball like we've seen him in the regular season, especially given the the limitations that he might have physically, you know, I think there could be a scenario where the Knicks walk away with this series.
Yep. I 100% agree. And I think you're hitting on it, but one of the things that I noticed when I went back, and, you know, it's interesting, the Knicks, the game that I think most was interesting for kind of recreating what could happen in this series, the Knicks blew out the Sixers in that 128-92 game. And, you know, ignoring the score, as odd as it sounds to say that, I think there were things Philly did that could bother the Knicks, and I think there were things the Knicks did that could bother the Sixers that are repeatable. The actual shot-making stuff is going to be whatever. The Knicks had just a pretty incredible all-around game on that front, but I think one of the things that jumped out to me where I was like, oh, this could be a concern, is the Sixers could get really good looks out of just getting Embiid on the move at the top of the key with a spread floor and letting him kind of just put his shoulder down and get to the basket versus Hartenstein. And, you know, as the Knicks adjusted in various defensive possessions, one of the things that they did was they just pinched the guard so far into the elbow. There's a couple possessions, and I pointed one out in there where like Deuce McBride is past the elbow. His left foot is basically in like the center of the foul line, helping out to build this wall versus Embiid. You have Hart on the opposite end. And what that allowed Philly to do was get really good open three-point shots for guys like Oubre. There's one for Morris in there, you know, and with the trade, with, you know, with that being Buddy Hield, that becomes a much more compromising proposition. At the same time, if Embiid can't move the same, right, and the mid-range shooting, as you've said, has been a struggle in the playoffs for lots of reasons, including injuries, right, if the Knicks are going to be able to be far more content letting him just go one-on-one and pull up for mid-rangers and long mid-rangers versus Hartenstein and versus Mitch and just basically live with contests, I think Philly's ability to consistently generate good shots will dwindle fast. And that's one of the first things I'm going to look for in this series is my guess is the Knicks will start out with a lot more single coverage in game one and basically test whether or not they need to be doing what they were doing in that game where they pinched the guards in. Now, if Embiid starts smoking Hartenstein and smoking Mitch, which he has done when healthy many times, I think the first adjustment will be okay. Our guards are going to help pretty aggressively and we're going to get the ball out of our hands. And then we're going to see if Philly's role players are kind of ready for this 3-point shooting variance moment type thing.
Yeah. I found that video clip you sent so fascinating because, you know, I think it's called like a full court shell, whereas like that's most teams' defensive strategy in transition where it's like, let's get that center, our center, to the free throw line area to try to take away driving lanes. But with Philadelphia, they can throw it to the top to Embiid. Yep. And then all of a sudden you need like not only the guy guarding Embiid to be there, you need another couple of either one or two guys right in that area to slow down his drives, which, yeah, as you talked about, opened up some wide open shots in those first couple of seconds of the shot clock. But that provides, yeah, such a different sort of element that teams attack with. Oklahoma City, I think, has utilized that well as well, of like taking advantage of that deep shell and yep. setting flare screens for Chet and those sorts of things.
I do think that the Knicks wing personnel is uniquely situated for a series like this because OG is such a menace on the weak side as a helper at the nail. He does kind of everything you could ask a wing to do. He's so strong. He has great hands. And I think one of the reasons this trade unlocked the Knicks defense so much is that they were already getting, you know, basically all defense level center play out of Hartenstein, kind of out of nowhere. Mitch has always been not necessarily an all defense level center, but certainly a really good defensive player that can bother lots of shots at the rim when he's not fouling. You add in a guy like OG, who is just so savvy at these digs, and when a guy turns their back and making those passes uncomfortable, and that's where you start to see guys like Embiid have their processing speed challenged as half court readers, right? When the guy can kind of recover and close those gaps much quicker, you add in, you know, Hart and DiVincenzo and then Deuce McBride getting a lot more minutes. These are guys who are just super physical, handsy wing defenders. You add in kind of the NBA's not new rules, but, you know, guided officiating on, hey, we're going to let them play a little bit more. It makes closing out a little bit more physical. And I think that type of stuff will really help the Knicks if they're able to play Embiid straight up on more possessions.
Yeah. And like another side effect of if Embiid is not fully right is, yeah, he plays a little bit slower, right? And we saw that in that play-in game against Miami. There was a play where he was kind of dribbling at the free throw line. He turned his back. Jimmy Butler on the left wing comes from behind and steals it. I could easily see OG making that exact same play.
And it is interesting to look at that Philly game and think about, well, would Tibbs be willing to go zone against Philadelphia? Because I think in the first half, Philadelphia looked so out of sorts against the zone. And then in the second half, they basically did what seemed like the pretty obvious adjustment and said, hey, Maxi, you know, just beat the guy at the top of the key and break it down for a kick out three. Would the Knicks wrinkle in a little bit more zone than they've run this year? They don't like to. I am curious if early on the Knicks are struggling in man, if they would throw that in as a wrinkle. They have a lot of good personnel for it. And it's the type of adjustment I would like to see from Tibbs, even if it's a different look to throw at that Sixer offense in the half court.
Yeah. I will say though, it's hard to match what Miami and Spoelstra does with that zone defense. And they do such a good job of that zone sort of morphing depending on where the offense is, where the players are positioned. I think like part of the reason why Philadelphia was able to figure it out in the second half was like Batum figuring out, oh, if I go to this corner, that draws this defender away and that opens things up for Maxey or Embiid. It'll be fascinating to see. Yeah, I would venture to guess, and you brought up Tibbs and maybe his willingness or unwillingness to make adjustments. I think that's a good transition into like the coaching matchup here. Nick Nurse, obviously, both these guys have a lot of playoff experience. I would venture to guess, though, that if I had to pick, like in terms of a guy that's going to make the in-game adjustments that'll help his team, I would probably lean towards Nurse. But, I think Tibbs did a pretty good job in last year's playoffs.
Yeah, I actually think this is one of the more interesting coaching matchups, and you hit the nail on the head. I think that if you were asking me which coach I was more confident to fix a first quarter problem, fix something he's seen in the first half, kind of at the half, I would take Nurse. I think that the in-game adjustment stuff from him has always been kind of a strong suit. His willingness to try things until something works, I think has always kind of been his strength. At the same time, I think the area where Tibbs is actually largely underrated as a coach is I think he's a really good game planner. I think the Knicks are always really tuned into the scout. Yes. I think if you watch that Cleveland series last year, I think game to game, the Knicks made really good adjustments in the way that they were covering Mitchell. I also think, you know, we're backtracking the playoffs, but one of the things that, you know, the Cavs adjusted with in game two last year was, hey, we're going to blitz Brunson more and we're going to test the Knicks centers in short roll. And they blew him out in game two. Well, Tibbs came back in game three and had RJ Barrett set the screens and kind of unlocked him as a short roller and got the Knicks offense going again. I do think game over game, he is a really good coach in this area. And I'm confident that if he sees stuff in game one that's working versus Philly, the Knicks will be able to get it implemented for the rest of the series in a really effective way.
Yeah. And I think another reason why maybe Tibbs gets kind of the short shrift on his playoff coaching is because in the regular season, I think he might be, as you mentioned, the best guy at locking in on tendencies and game plans. His teams are so well set up and organized in the regular season that, yes, like they're still well set up in the postseason, but there's not like that drastic difference, right? And it's same with the minutes. Most coaches are going to play their guys in the regular season 34 to 36 minutes a night and then ramp that up to 38 to 40 in the postseason. Well, Tibbs just says, screw that. We're going to play 38 to 40 in the regular season. So, you know, getting into like the depth of these two teams, I think the Knicks probably do have better depth. But given that, like, you know, again, all of their starters are mostly already playing heavy minutes, I think it'll be interesting to see if Embiid can ramp up. And I think he played 38 minutes in that Miami play-in game. If he can continue to play that many minutes throughout the length of the series. But it's one of those things where the Knicks are maybe their regular season record overrates them a little bit because of those things that Tibbs does. It's more a compliment of his regular season coaching, but then there isn't that ramp up then to the postseason.
I think one of the best kind of analogies I've heard for how Tibbs coaches the regular season is Tibbs just always throws his best pitch and doesn't mix it up. The Knicks coach regular season games like their playoff games. And I think the Atlanta Knicks series is a really good example of this, where the Knicks were better than Atlanta during the regular season. Then Atlanta started, you know, scaling their best players up more minutes and the talent gap kind of opened itself up. I think the flip side of that is this version of the Knicks is way more talented than that one is. And the players are really good. The players have a lot of playoff experience on this Knicks team, which is very different. Brunson's super playoff experienced. OG's obviously been on a team that has made a couple deep runs. And, you know, he was hurt during that finals run, but has made one of those. DiVincenzo has been a championship player. This is not, you know, the typical kind of 2-3 years ago Knicks team where it was like, how are they going to look as a unit? They're kind of battle tested. They were a second round team last year. So I do think that even though, you know, Tibbs coached the regular season, meaning he coached game 82 very differently from how Cleveland coached game 82. I do think some of that kind of bleeds into the DNA of the team where they are just super competitive all the time. There's very much a, you know, whatever it takes mentality that you see the Knicks have when they're playing in terms of the hustle and the physicality. So I think it'll be interesting to see. And you know, you talked a ton with a ton of really smart people about other playoff series that are going on. I think for me, the Knicks and the Sixers have probably the most interesting game one of the playoffs. Maybe not the most interesting series overall, but game one is going to tell us a lot specifically about how healthy Embiid is, how the Knicks are willing to guard him, what the minutes look like for everybody in the series, and also just generally, how do the Sixers kind of role players scale up offensively in a series like this versus kind of a one game elimination versus the Heat?
Absolutely. And again, something that you mentioned on Twitter, a few actions that I wanted to get your takes on, and perhaps like how the Knicks are going to try to defend these. The one that was the most interesting to me was the Spain action that the Sixers are running, because it does two things for them. So they essentially have Embiid set a screen for Maxey, right? And then they have a wing, whether that would be like Batum or Tobias Harris or Kelly Oubre, set a back screen on Embiid. And so they get essentially Tyrese Maxey, one of the fastest players in the NBA, going downhill. And you potentially get Embiid behind the defense to potentially grab the offensive rebound if Maxey were to miss. That just seems like such a difficult action to stop. How do you feel like the Knicks should handle that?
Yeah, so I won't lie. When I saw that in that Knicks game, I did get a little bit of PTSD from the Atlanta Knicks series where in game one, the Hawks ran four straight Spain actions at the Knicks, all for buckets down the stretch of game one.
I remember this. Yes.
Prior to the Trey win. And it does seem like a familiar, you know, difficult set for the Knicks as a whole to stop. But I think there's a couple things. One, it's play recognition early. It's being able for Brunson to get into a better position. You know, Brunson's one of the best charge takers in the league this year. He might actually have been number one in charges taken this year. Getting into a position where he can make that Maxey drive either a charge or make Maxey divert a little bit further from the basket in terms of his path. That's where you can get the digs from the corners that the Knicks are really good at. So that's one thing. Two, the other thing is just the back screener has to be really aware, because whoever's guarding Batum there has to bump Embiid and give Hartenstein an opportunity to actually kind of slip back inside and recover. There's a lot of kind of just recognition of the action, noticing Batum kind of coming up from the baseline to get ready for it. If you can call that out, Hartenstein can turn his body and kind of get over that screen in terms of the coverage. I think the other thing is, in actions like that, that one didn't show the counter, but sometimes, you know, Philly will have Batum pop out for a three there if both guys stick with Embiid, and Maxey will just rip that open for a top of the key three. So, you know, how does Batum shoot in this series? Well, he was the big factor in the Heat game. He is definitely one of the kind of three swing guys on the wing for the Sixers that'll determine a lot of the variance part of this series. And I think the Knicks have to be super in tune with those types of sets. In terms of the backline help, like, we've spent very little time talking about Maxey so far. I am concerned about Maxey. I will say that the Knicks, I thought, did a really, really awesome job overall on him in that blowout game and the other games. Now, granted, grain of salt when you're not playing with Embiid, of course, but OG has shown a really good ability to bother him with his length, and the fact that OG can kind of give him some ground at the top of the key while also getting out to his jumper. I think the Knicks have one of the better matchups for Maxey in the league with this kind of guy, and McBride off the bench.
Yeah. OG's versatility is going to be on full display. I think defensive versatility is going to be on full display in this series. You know, speaking again to that Spain pick and roll, I think a couple of other things that the Knicks could consider. It takes great communication to pull this off, but like, if they're trying to bring Brunson into that action, they could try to kick out switch and, you know, send somebody else into that play. The other option that I've seen some teams do, it's like a three-way switch where you have the guy that's defending the back screener on Embiid actually come over and guard and switch yep. onto the ball handler.
Yep.
And then that player comes over and defends that back screener.
Yep.
And then, as you said, whoever that is, though, they have to make sure that they can give Embiid a little body check, slow him down as much as possible, so that, whatever Knicks center is guarding Embiid can get back into the play. But, yeah, that's going to be fascinating. I also think, like, yeah, you talked about it, that McBride is also a good option. I even think DiVincenzo, with his size, he's been a pretty strong defender, I think, this year. They've got multiple guys to throw at Maxey, which I think is really important in this series. Speaking to the other end, another guy that I think is going to be it'll be interesting to see if he plays, if he's healthy. I don't know if you've heard any updates, but DeAnthony Melton, he yep. did not play in that play-in game against Miami. But he's a guy, especially against Brunson, that I think if he's out there, he is a huge X factor because they've basically played Lowry in that role ever since Melton has been out and since they acquired Lowry. But Melton's got a 6'8 wingspan. Lowry's a 6'2, right? And while Lowry is tough, physical, he plays hard, Melton's just more athletic as well at this stage of his career. So I think he's the guy, if there's going to be one guy on this Sixers team that can really give Brunson issues, especially like challenging from behind and getting over screens, and even if they are dropping, still making things difficult, it's Melton.
In my X factors for the Sixers notes, I had Lowry and the Melton help alongside Batum. And I 100% agree, because I think if you're looking at the Sixers roster, one of the things, if you go back to that blowout game, that, you know, stands out in terms of a difference now is that version of the Sixers had Patrick Beverley. And I think you would have had him in a lot higher minute role in a series like this for a guy like Brunson. Melton would be their guy for this. Melton is, as you said, it's the length. It's that he's able to kind of be at Brunson's level. He's very footwork savvy. He's, you know, just been in a lot of games like this. He snakes pick and rolls really well without fouling. He can contest from behind. I think, you know, on the other end, DiVincenzo is a great example of this for the Knicks. But I agree. I think he's a huge factor in the series. I think Lowry looked good in that Heat game, and they have kind of used him in this role. At the same time, I don't think he gives you the same juice he used to defensively, not even like used to, but as recently as like 2 years ago type thing. And I think that, you know, the Knicks are so physical in how they screen with Hardenstein and Mitch, just big dudes to get around. And I think that the length that Melton would provide the Sixers would give them a huge lift. I haven't heard an update. I know that they were hoping he'd be ready, but it seems like at least he wouldn't be ready for game one from what I've read so far, at the bare minimum. But I 100% agree that, you know, in terms of the X factors of the series, the guys that are tasked with the Brunson assignment, especially if Embiid's not going to be, you know, as capable in the help area of pick and roll coverage, is going to kind of dictate how well the Knicks offense is able to get good looks.
Yeah. And Melton, he missed a huge chunk of the season. It's a back issue that he's been dealing with which that's nothing to, nothing to sneeze about, but he came back for a couple of games towards the end of the season. And now is, you know, I think the reason he was out against Miami, they called it back injury management. So that's definitely concerning. And as you said, I think Lowry is a decent stopgap there. Yeah. Like he's obviously very strong. He like in his prime, Kyle Lowry was one of the best help guard defenders in the entire league, but he's just not quite at that level anymore, given his age, as you would expect. But yeah, let's get into our X factors. We've already brought up a few, but I guess I'll mention I had three names that were my guys. So, we talked about at the outset, Bojan Bogdanović. I think the Knicks, in the event that Embiid is, you know, really dominating on the offensive end, the Knicks are going to have to keep up offensively, which means they're going to have to score reasonably well with Brunson off the floor. Bojan is going to be crucial to that. And can he hide on a Tobias Harris or a Kelly Oubre well enough that it's not going to kill them on that end of the floor? Hartenstein, obviously, I think he's, you know, the Knicks have four playable centers if you include Achiuwa and like Jericho Sims.
Yep.
But Hartenstein, again, to me, is the one guy that really will allow their offense to hum.
Yep.
While maintaining a really good defensive play. And like we already talked about the potential issue where he's foul prone and Embiid is one of the best at. So Hartenstein staying out of foul trouble and producing on the offensive end is going to be critical. And then, yeah, D'Anthony Melton was the final guy I had because, like, yeah, I think Brunson could be talking about him averaging 35 a game in this series if Embiid is unable to do anything other than a deep drop and Melton doesn't play. Like, Brunson will just kill him.
Yep, I 100% agree. And I think you took, and I took slightly different approaches here. I thought about offensive and defensive side of the ball for each team as an X factor. And I mentioned earlier, I had Hartenstein as well as kind of my Knicks offensive X factor, just because of what he unlocks for Brunson, that little in-between floater game that actually kind of punishes super deep dropping bigs, and just the passing juice that he provides for the Knicks that I think, you know, for the basketball sickos, I'll call them, doesn't go underrated. But I think for a lot of people that are just generally watching a Knicks game, don't realize what that little extra that he can do in terms of hitting back cutters or giving a hard screen as he's handing the ball off to us for the Knicks offense. I think on the defensive end, I had OG and Deuce. And I think the reason is this changed for me a little bit with the compromised Embiid, but I think that with Embiid not at full health, Maxey becomes such a critical part of the Sixers offense. And he already is when Embiid is healthy anyway, but he becomes an even more critical part in terms of initiating their offense. If Embiid isn't giving you his usual, you know, God level 35 points a game on crazy efficiency. And in turn, that's where the Knicks will turn to OG to be the stopper that they acquired for what was not a small package at the midway mark this year. And vice versa, I think when they traded IQ to the Raptors, one of the big gambles that the Knicks were making as a roster was that Deuce McBride was ready for this kind of role. I think, you know, as one of the OG, I'll say other people had a lot of love for Deuce in the draft when he was coming out. He was definitely one of those like deep draft Twitter guys for a long time. Super good defensive prospect. He can pick up 90 feet and bother people. Now, granted, nobody's going to do that to Tyrese Maxey, but he's so physical. He's so quick in front of the ball. He's switchable on wings that are shooters. I think the two of them, especially when Deuce has to spell Brunson or compliment Brunson as the off guard, those are the guys you're going to see get the Maxey assignment and really dictate how well the Knicks defend. We talked earlier about, you know, X's and O's, and we talked a little bit about pick and roll coverages, which I know you love to get into. The thing that you notice when you watch the Knicks play the Sixers is how reluctant they are to get Brunson matched up onto Maxey. The Knicks are really cognizant of avoiding that matchup at pretty much all costs. It reminds me a little bit of how the Warriors handled Steph before he kind of elevated as a defensive player, where they spend a lot of time hiding him, hard hedging him out, and trusting the first guard to get over or get under. But the Knicks are going to do everything in their power to not switch that matchup. And if they're not going to switch that matchup, it's a pretty big burden on the OGs and Deuces of the world, and even DiVincenzo to an extent, to be really, really, really on top of their game, getting over screens, bothering Maxey, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Obviously, Tibbs has grown a fondness for Deuce, especially this year. I think there was a game he played 46 minutes. And I think the biggest thing for Deuce is you said it, that like he came out of the draft, I think even as a rookie, was a solid defensive guard. It's just the offensive game needed to come around, and he's finally knocking down shots and able to be a solid two-way option for this team. So, yeah, that's a great call as another X factor in this series. So, this is kind of a complicated question because it could depend like how the series is going, whether the Knicks or Sixers are losing because they're not scoring well enough or they're just not able to defend and get stops. But, you know, looking at a potential scenario where, say, you know, the Knicks get down 0-2 in this series and it looks like Embiid's dominating, what sort of, you know, you mentioned that maybe Tibbs is a little underrated as a game-to-game adjuster. What sort of adjustments might he make to try to flip the series around?
Yeah, and I think it depends on which side of the ball. But if I was guessing, if you told me that the Knicks were down 2-0, my guess is that the problem would be coming on the offensive end, whether they're not making enough shots or the Sixers defense kind of was up to the task. Maybe Embiid looked a little healthier by Saturday than he did on Tuesday, that sort of thing. And I think kind of the obvious thing there is they would probably have to scale down their minutes at the five for guys that aren't as great offensively, whether that means Mitchell Robinson playing less. And I think in turn, you know, a guy that plays a lot for the Knicks that is a very weird situational player is Josh Hart. I think a lot about, you know, how great he was in that kind of Cleveland series last year, and then the way that the Knicks asked him to guard, you know, Jimmy Butler in that Heat series. This is a guy where, you know, it's hard to know if this is the series for him or it's not. But that's a guy where if the Knicks need more offensive juice, I could see them scaling the minutes down for him and increasing, you know, Boyan's minutes or even, you know, going into Burks, who has kind of fallen out of favor recently, but was originally very much a Tibbs guy. That would be my guess if the Knicks are down 2-0. And in turn, if the Knicks are up 2-0, my guess there is it's because they're able to kind of single up on Embiid and dig at him rather than have to send true, consistent, static doubles at him.
Yeah. One of the things I brought up is like, if Embiid is truly a problem, It's a little bit difficult because I think one of the big advantages of what Nick Nurse has brought to the Sixers offense this year is it's less just static post-ups on the block, and it's more Embiid facing up from the perimeter at the free throw line, almost a la Dirk Nowitzki at times, which just makes it harder to send doubles, right? But there's still opportunities, again, as I referenced earlier, that play where Jimmy Butler came from behind and stole it from Embiid. Like altering when you send doubles, right? It's one thing if he's just holding the ball, looking at the floor, and then you send a double. That makes the pass pretty easy, right? Whereas if he takes a dribble or two, then you bring the double. Just mixing things up, you know, whether you're doubling from the strong side or the weak side. Against great players, those are the things you have to consistently do throughout the course of a seven-game series to keep them off balance.
Yep, I 100% agree. And I think the Knicks will test his processing speed early and often with where they're sending help from and that sort of things.
All right. So, let's see. Let's get into the series prediction now. Do you want to go first? Or you want me to go first?
I'm happy to go first.
Okay. All right. Let's hear it.
I will be taking the Knicks in six in this series. I think that I would feel differently maybe about this series. I was pretty bullish on Philly to start this season. I think that from a roster perspective, it's really well built around Embiid. I just think that, and you know, I say unfortunately, not necessarily as a Knicks fan, but more just as an overall basketball fan. Yeah. I think that a lot of how I thought Embiid looked in that Miami game physically has kind of been sitting in my brain for the last couple of days as I thought about where I think this series was going. And the other thing is just the Knicks have not given me a reason to doubt that this is real, that they are at the level of a top three team in the East. I think about, you know, juxtaposing that with Milwaukee, where you ask a lot of people that watch a lot of Bucks basketball how they feel about Milwaukee. You could look at the record and most people will tell you they feel terrible about how the Bucks have looked for a couple months. And you look up and the Knicks have kind of just taken care of business. They've plowed through what was a really rough injury stretch. They've gotten some pretty critical pieces back. I think at the end of the day, the way the Sixers like to defend coverage-wise plays very well into the Knicks' hands. And I think just unfortunately with how Embiid is compromised, their ability to adjust will be limited. Whereas I think the Knicks will have a lot more avenues to kind of course correct the series if things go wrong early. So I'm going to take the Knicks in six.
All right. I mean, I'm pretty similar. I'm going to go Knicks in seven. Just because, again, I do think that there could be a game or two where Nick Nurse just pulls some magic out of the hat. I also think, even a 70% Embiid could have a game where he just, you know, still draws a bunch of fouls, still gets 10 to 12 trips to the free throw line, and just dominates, despite the fact that he's, pretty slow and, immobile out there. But I think the Knicks just have a little bit too much. They're just a really good basketball team. As you said, like, I mean, obviously part of that regular season finale was just Tibbs' mindset. And Zach Lowe's poked fun at this on the low post and like, we're going to win no matter what. But like, I also think like the Knicks just aren't scared of anyone. Like, no. I think they believe in what they do. They believe in their talent. And this is a confident basketball team that has some postseason experience under their belt. And, you know, there's not really any weak links on this roster and in this playoff rotation. I think they're pretty solid from top to bottom. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a really tight series. If Embiid was fully healthy, I'd probably go Sixers, but that's just not what I've seen from him. I think the Knicks have enough. And I'm going to talk with Darius Scott on Orlando Cleveland a little later today. One of the things I was just so angry at the Cavs for doing what they did in that final regular season game. It was just so cowardly. And it also just lacked ambition too. It's like, you know, is the goal to win one playoff series or is it to advance as far as possible? And the Knicks being the two seed, getting home court advantage in a potential second round series, gave themselves a better chance of advancing further into the playoffs than the Cavs did by saying, okay, yeah, maybe we get a slightly easier first round series, but then we're guaranteed to play Boston.
It was a really interesting kind of game theory exercise to watch play out in real time where the Knicks were like, cool, we'll take the extra home court game if we can get there in round two. we'll take the harder round one opponent, and we think we can beat either team. And Cleveland basically said, we'll take the path of least resistance in round one and take our swing at by far the hardest team you can get in round two. Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it on the head. I think it said a lot about both organizations. And honestly, like, it wasn't, it does kind of reflect how both organizations have treated the season in a way, which is really interesting. Cleveland's been much more measured, much more up and down, much more kind of flimsy in how we feel about them. And the Knicks were like, yeah, we're going to try to beat Coby White and Caruso, and we're going to play DiVincenzo 50 plus minutes. And the goal is to win. And we didn't start the game to lose it. So we're not going to try to lose it now.
All right, Brett. Well, why don't you tell the people again your Twitter handle, anything else you got going on?
I got nothing going on. I'm at Corn Hoops. You read it way better than I did at the beginning of the podcast. I appreciate you having me on. This was super fun, and hopefully we get to run one back for round two if the Knicks are there.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, thanks again for coming on. This was a blast. And again, if you're not following Brett, do so. It's a great follow. He puts out great stuff about the Knicks and the NBA in general. So again, thanks again, Brett.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.